Today is Thursday, the 1st of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The Democratic Party-controlled House of Representatives votes to form a special committee to investigate the January 6th riot at the Capitol building.
Those 13 people are broadly empowered to call witnesses, to compel testimony, to get documents, basically to look into what Democrats call a domestic terrorism event.
Plus, trying to bridge the information gap of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. Well, these stories and more next. The House of Representative Democrats voted to approve a special select committee to investigate the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol building after a bipartisan effort failed to get enough votes to pass earlier. Joining us is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. So, Catherine, where I want to begin is, what exactly does this select committee do, and how is it different than other committees? Because a criticism from Republicans is that there are other committees looking into the January 6th riot at the Capitol.
That's right. So we have a lot of different committees and commissions up in discussion on Capitol Hill who could be looking into the events of January 6th. What was created specifically today is what's called the Select Committee, which some may remember as the designation for the Select Committee on the events in Benghazi, which looked into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's wide-ranging accusations against her from House Republicans, kind of a broad investigation that can be conducted by members of the U.S. House of Representatives. So basically today, what is happening is that Speaker Pelosi is being empowered to select 13 members of the U.S. House, and she is supposed to consult with Republicans on five of those members, but ultimately she is able to decide who serves in those positions. Those 13 people are broadly empowered to call witnesses, to compel testimony, to get documents, basically to look into what Democrats call a domestic terrorism event when the supporters of Donald Trump rioted at the U.S. Capitol and attempted to overturn the counting of Electoral College votes for then-President-elect Joe Biden. So really a broad-ranging investigation here that was created today.
You brought up the Benghazi Select Committee, and I wanted to ask you about that because some Republicans have criticized the Democratic leadership in the House for creating this Select Committee. But when Republicans were in charge of the House, they created their own Select Committee for the Benghazi investigation. I was wondering if House Republicans and Democrats commented about that, because these were both what the opposition would call partisan efforts.
Right, exactly. And that goes back to some of the other investigations that have already been going on in the U.S. House into the events of January 6th. You know, there are several committees of jurisdiction: House Homeland Security, House Judiciary, the House Oversight Committee, who are already empowered to look at bits and pieces of this problem, you know, looking at the security failures of that day, looking at some of the implications of having such a large domestic terrorism event. But really, when you step back, what each side is saying is that there either needs to be a broader investigation for a select committee, or this broad investigation is really too broad, which is what Republicans are saying. They're pointing to those previous investigations in each House committee and saying, look, all of this has already been looked at and examined. There is nothing new here. And that goes back to the debate over Benghazi, which, of course, Democrats said was far too broad, went on for far too long, and was really what they called a witch hunt against Hillary Clinton.
Catherine, do we have any idea of when this committee is going to be up and running? Because lawmakers are about ready to leave for the July 4th Independence Day holiday.
Sure. Well, even the schedule for this committee has become a partisan issue, because you have a lot of Republicans saying that it shouldn't go on for too long and go into 2022, of course, when there will be the start of the midterm election cycle, when all of these lawmakers have to run for re-election. Democrats have assured Republicans that that will not happen. But of course, when you look at the timeline in the U.S. House, as you mentioned, they're out for the 4th of July break. They're out for another 6 weeks starting in August. And there's a lot on their plate in terms of passing an infrastructure deal, passing a budget for the U.S. government. And Speaker Pelosi has to appoint those members and get them seated and up to speed to do the work of that committee.
Catherine Gibson is VOA's congressional correspondent. Charges are expected on Thursday against the organization that bears former President Donald Trump's name, as well as a top executive. Associated Press correspondent Mike Gracia is up next.
Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr. has led a two-year probe into the Trump Organization. The charges against the company and Chief Financial Officer Alan Weisselberg appear to involve non-monetary benefits the company gave to top executives, possibly including use of apartments, cars, and school tuition. Weisselberg came under scrutiny in part because of questions about his son's use of a Trump apartment at little or no cost. Barry Weisselberg managed a Trump-operated ice rink in Central Park. His ex-wife, Jen Weisselberg, has been cooperating with the investigation. I'm Mike Gracia.
U.S. President Joe Biden this week assured visiting Israeli President Reuven Rivlin that the United States will not allow Iran to become a nuclear power. Despite the assurances, many Israelis are skeptical. As the United States seeks to rejoin the Iran nuclear deal, Israeli analysts say Iran is moving closer to a nuclear bomb. Linda Gradstein has more.
When outgoing Israeli President Reuven Rivlin met with U.S. President Joe Biden in Washington Monday, they discussed the contentious issue of Iran's nuclear program.
Iran will never get a nuclear weapon on my watch, as they say.
We are sharing values of democracy and values of liberalism. And because of that, of course, we, according to a real friendship, can from time to time discuss matters and even agree not to agree about everything. But we count on you in your really declaration just now.
Israel's new Prime Minister Naftali Bennett took a hard line on Iran in his first cabinet meeting.
The last chance for the world powers to wake up before returning to the nuclear agreement and to understand who they're doing business with. These guys are murderers, mass murderers. A regime of brutal hangmen must never be allowed to have weapons of mass destruction that will enable it to not to kill thousands but millions. Israel's position will not change on this.
In reports later confirmed by outgoing Mossad head Yossi Cohen, Israel has conducted a series of actions, including attacks on an Iranian nuclear reactor in Natanz and assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists to set back the Iranian nuclear program. These included a raid inside Iran in which Israel captured an extensive Iranian archive, which it revealed in 2018. Iran has repeatedly said it did not intend to acquire nuclear weapons.
Iran lied. Big time. After signing the nuclear deal in 2015, Iran intensified its efforts to hide its secret nuclear files. In 2017, Iran moved its nuclear weapons files to a highly secret location in Tehran. This is the Shorabad district in southern Tehran. This is where they kept the atomic archives.
Some Israeli analysts say that Iran is closer today to a nuclear bomb than ever before, accelerating development after former President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, also known as the JCPOA, in 2018.
Every day that passes, Iran goes on with its nuclear development, enriching uranium, spinning centrifuges, and doing other things in hidden places, as the IAEA said in recent statement. And I think now we are on the crossroads.
But trying to turn up the pressure on Iran is a mistake, say some Israeli analysts.
This is not the way. What it makes them do is it makes them stronger in their own opinions, in their own status from before. It makes them close instead of open. And It makes them distrust their partner.
Israeli media reports say Israel has prepared plans for a possible large-scale attack on Iran's nuclear facilities, regardless of whether the U.S. rejoins the Iran nuclear deal. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
The UN Secretary General has called on the United States to lift its sanctions on Iran and for both countries to return to the 2015 nuclear deal. UN Undersecretary General for Political and Peacebuilding Affairs Rosemary DiCarlo echoed Guterres's comments.
Lift or waive its sanctions outlined in the plan. Extend the waivers with regard to the trade in oil with Iran and to once again facilitate nuclear-related activities consistent with the plan and the resolution. These activities relate to non-proliferation projects, including at the Bashar nuclear power plant, the Fordow facility, and the Iraq reactor. These are needed steps to facilitate the full implementation of the plan and Resolution 2231, as well as to enable the Iranian people to secure the tangible benefits foreseen by the plan.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. VOA Pashto Service reporter Shaista Sadat recently spoke with Annie Forsheimer. She's the former acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Afghanistan until March of 2019. And from 2017 to 2018, she was the Deputy Chief of Mission in Kabul. She's now a non-resident associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington. They began their conversation by discussing the concern many have over the uncertainty facing the country after the U.S. and NATO forces complete their withdrawal.
I absolutely understand the reason that people are expressing this fear, because there has been so much uncertainty in the manner of the U.S. and NATO withdrawal, including some very conflicting public messages. And all of those elements are truly avoidable and should have been avoided. Because in this kind of war, there's the battlefield advantage, but there's also a psychological war. And unfortunately, these actions have given a psychological advantage to the Taliban and to forces who are trying to oppose the government.
Yes. Some ask that why President Biden did not warn Taliban to stop the violence or face the airstrike during President Ghani's trip to D.C. And many believe that it could have had a tremendous positive impact on the level of the violence that is taking place right now. What do you think?
Well, I think, although I may not agree with the idea of threatening airstrikes, that the U.S. absolutely should have made much more, clear warnings and statements in this regard to the Taliban. But the U.S. has many ways that it could be bolstering the Afghan security forces, and I believe we should be using every means at our disposal that is still within the human rights parameters of waging conflict.
And where do you think women are, women of Afghanistan, in the middle of this fear and chaos? How concerned are you for their future as they can remember the bitter memories of, the past by the Taliban and warlords as well?
Exactly. I am very concerned. I have some people that I speak to within Afghanistan, others who are working with women in Afghanistan, and I hear the same thing over and over again. The fear and uncertainty is almost unbearable. And what they are worried about is either what the Taliban might impose or the idea of a civil war, a conflict of self-arming militias, which has already begun. And the most vulnerable populations at a moment like this are women and children.
With Taliban's so fast, advancement, where do you see Afghan women within, two next years?
I think that in some cases, women are going to become part of the very terrible legacy of wartime, which could be internally displaced people or even refugees who are forced to leave Afghanistan and cross an international border. Some of them may leave one part of the country and move to the safer parts, the cities, for example. Other women may be involved in some version of self-defense. Some of them are in the security forces. And others are going to stay where they are to bear witness to what is happening. I am very concerned, however, that far too many of them will become victims of the conflict one way or another.
Annie Forsheimer was the former acting Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Afghanistan and is a current non-resident associate with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. She was speaking to VOA Pashto service reporter Shayus Sadat. The U.S. Pentagon says it will leave a number of troops that is much larger than a typical security detail to guard its embassy in Kabul, along with American forces at the Kabul airport to help protect the vital facility for a time. The Pentagon would not confirm reports about the specific numbers of troops that will stay after withdrawal from the country is complete. Germany and Italy have removed their last remaining soldiers from Afghanistan, ending almost two decades of deployment to the war-torn country alongside U.S. and other coalition troops. The United States and NATO militaries plan to fully withdraw their militaries from the South Asian nation by September 11th. In line with orders by U.S. President Joe Biden, the drawdown process formally began on May 1st. Several countries have imposed travel restrictions on travelers from Britain amid rising cases of the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Scientists say the Delta mutation is more infectious and now makes up around 95% of the new cases in Britain. Henry Ridgewell takes it from here.
London's Wembley Stadium hosted England's victory over Germany in the UEFA Euro Football Championship Tuesday. Wembley is also scheduled to host the semi-finals and final, but the European Union wants the matches relocated. Margaritis Skinas, the European Commission Vice President, spoke to reporters in Brussels Wednesday.
Because there will be lots of people, and the idea of a full stadium at the moment we're so worried about the Delta variant.
That concern will be amplified by COVID data from Scotland published Wednesday, which showed that almost 2,000 new infections were associated with football fans travelling to London on June 18th. So far, European states have imposed different limitations on travellers from Britain. Germany has called for EU-wide restrictions. Simon Clark is a microbiologist at the University of Reading.
Without a thorough vaccination program, they are going to see increasing numbers of Delta variant as well. So they're just trying to buy themselves time.
But popular vacation destinations like Spain and Greece are resisting pressure for further restrictions. They are desperate for a bumper tourist season after a disastrous 2020. Hong Kong banned all passenger flights from Britain starting Thursday. These travellers raced to beat the deadline. This student returning from Britain said, "My original plan was to return from the UK on July 7th, but I was afraid I wouldn't be able to come back by then, so I decided to change to an earlier flight." Scientists believe the Delta variant came to Britain from India, where it was first detected in late 2020. Critics say the British government acted too slowly in imposing travel restrictions on India, though Britain denies this. Yet hospitalizations are expected to stay low, say some experts. Again, Simon Clark.
I don't think this time around there's a huge reason for a lot of concern. I think the numbers of hospitalizations will stay low.
That's because the coronavirus vaccines appear to be effective against the Delta variant, and almost two-thirds of British adults have received two doses. Once again, Simon Clark.
Two doses seem to provide really quite good protection, but it's not complete.
Britain is using millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but the drug has not yet been approved in the United States, complicating efforts to open a so-called travel corridor between the two countries. Britain still plans to end all domestic lockdown restrictions on July 19th. But other countries are tightening travel restrictions on Britain, an effort to buy time in the race between the Delta variant and the vaccines. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Efforts are taking place around the world to vaccinate as many people as possible to protect against COVID-19. Officials are tracking the safety and effectiveness of those efforts, but some medical experts say that they aren't getting the information they need on Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. Anna Rice narrates this story.
The results look too good to be true.
In May, an international group of scientists wrote an open letter to the medical journal The Lancet, expressing concern about Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. The scientists from the United States, the Netherlands, France, Italy, and Russia cited data discrepancies from Gamaleya Research Institute, the Moscow-based producer of Russia's Sputnik V vaccine. Specifically, during phase 3 trials, the institute reported that Sputnik V was effective against COVID over 91% of the time. But scientists say the institute did not provide raw data, so others could check their work and asked for more information from Gamaleya.
Had they provided access to all the source materials, some discrepancies could have been cleared up, but they never did that. So in regard to the results of this research, there are certain doubts that lead to ambiguity in our assessment.
In a response to this letter, Sputnik V developers attributed any discrepancies to simple typing errors and called the scientists' requests strange. Gamaleya researchers noted the vaccine has been approved for use in over 50 countries. But other researchers say that doesn't prove the vaccine is as safe and effective as the developers claim.
Developers of the internationally known Western vaccines not only published detailed reports about the research they've conducted, but also published the protocols they abided by when conducting research. While Russian scientists refused to publish such protocols, and that raises a lot of questions.
The Russian vaccine developers say their vaccine is safe and that Western medical researchers are being paid by the so-called Big Pharma to keep the Russian vaccine out of the world market. But medical researchers say makers of other vector vaccines, Johnson & Johnson and AstraZeneca, have been working closely with regulators to monitor the safety of their product, while the makers of the Sputnik V vaccine have not.
If the developers of Sputnik start behaving like the developers of Johnson & Johnson, it can simplify the situation dramatically, and it would help them in the first place. Are they going to do it? I don't know.
The World Health Organization say researchers are hoping to learn more during trips to Russia.
We have a team now, I think, who are inspecting the factory. So they go to the different sites and look at the processes.
But for now, Sputnik V hasn't made it to the list of vaccines approved for emergency use by the EU. Authors of the May letter criticizing the transparency of Sputnik V clinical trials say any problems with Sputnik could be easily solved. But reservations about the safety and efficacy of Sputnik V haven't stopped many countries, desperate for ways to fight COVID, from approving the vaccine for use in their countries. And millions of the vaccine have been administered in Russia and around the world. For Anusha Vittisyan in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
The World Health Organization has certified that China, which is the most populous country in the world, is malaria-free. Lisa Schlein has the details.
It has taken China 7 decades to reach this milestone. The country has gone from 30 million cases of malaria in the 1940s to 0 cases today. Director of the World Health Organization's Global Malaria Program, Pedro Alonso, tells VOA the achievement should act as an inspiration to other malaria endemic countries around the world.
That China, that at one point had 30 million cases of malaria every year, and that would place that country among the top two burden countries in the world, can actually drive down malaria and get rid of this scourge of mankind.
China is the first country in the WHO Western Pacific region to be awarded a malaria-free certification in more than three decades. Other countries in the region that have achieved that status include Australia, Singapore, and Brunei. Globally, 40 countries and territories have been declared malaria-free. The most recent include El Salvador, Algeria, Argentina, Paraguay, and Uzbekistan. Eliminating malaria is a long, complex process involving many factors. Alonso says economic development, improvement in people's living conditions, and the implementation of measures aimed at preventing, controlling, and treating malaria are critical for success.
Vector control, mostly through insecticide-treated bed nets, will, for the years to come, remain the backbone of our prevention efforts. Artemisinin combination therapies will remain the backbone of our treatment efforts.
The WHO estimates there are still 229 million new cases of malaria annually, leading to more than 400,000 deaths. Africa is home to 94% of those cases and deaths. Alonso says the mosquito in Africa is very effective in the transmission of malaria. This, he says, is one of the many reasons why it is particularly challenging to rid the continent of the disease.
And of course, all of this is compounded by lack of economic and social development, difficulties in communication, poverty, housing, lack of electricity. So it's a compounded effect. It's where China was 60 years ago, and where we are having a lot of difficulty even to maintain the gains achieved over the last 20 years.
While substantial progress in the prevention and control of malaria is possible with today's available tools, Alonso says only a highly effective vaccine can eradicate the disease. The WHO malaria chief says he is cautiously optimistic that such a vaccine is on the horizon. He notes a pilot project to develop the world's first malaria vaccine, RTS,S, in three countries in sub-Saharan Africa, has been shown to provide partial protection against malaria in young children. He says the vaccine, which was introduced in 2019, is likely not to be the hoped-for game changer everyone seeks, but he adds it is a very good start. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hong Kong authorities have used their new national security law as a pretext to curb dissent, according to a new Amnesty International report. Reuters' Libby Hogan.
1 year after a sweeping national security law was introduced in Hong Kong, Amnesty International has called the situation a human rights emergency. In their report released on Wednesday, Amnesty's regional director in Southeast Asia, Joshua Rosenzweig, pointed to a list of court decisions and interviews with activists that show the law has been used to target dissent, justify censorship and arrests.
There does seem to be a political element to this, where there's some of these charges and prosecutions appear to be politically motivated and designed to curb political opposition and silence voices that the government doesn't want.
Beijing imposed the national security law to punish anything it deems as subversion, secession, colluding with foreign forces and terrorism, with up to life in prison. Authorities have said the law would affect an extremely small minority of people and that it had restored stability after months of often violent protests in 2019. According to a Reuters tally, more than 100 people have been arrested and more than 60 charged in the first year under the new law. Amnesty has sounded the alarm and said the actions under the law, including harassment and prosecutions, violate human rights.
You know, we're calling on the United Nations, particularly the Human Rights Council, but also the High Commissioner for Human Rights, to really look into the way in which national security, terrorism, and these other concepts are being used by the Chinese government more broadly to target and limit the enjoyment of human rights.
The Hong Kong government did not immediately respond to requests for comment.
Libby Hogan reports for Reuters News. And finally, Donald Rumsfeld, the U.S. Defense Secretary under former U.S. President George W. Bush, has died at the age of 88. A family statement said that he passed away while surrounded by them in Taos, New Mexico, but didn't specify when. Rumsfeld was one of the architects of President Bush's Iraq War that toppled Saddam Hussein. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington.